Counsel, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please.
3 minutes?
Yes, ma'am.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jessica Bailey, and I am court appointed counsel for Ryan Davis, the appellant in this matter. Mr. Davis was convicted of first-degree murder after having been previously convicted of two prior violent felonies. The issues that the court is considering today are whether or not the trial court erred by admitting the opinion, evidence, and testimony from the medical examiner by way of her oral testimony and by way of
Let me ask you a question there, because you're about to say oral testimony and the admission of the report.
Yes,
and
sir.
At trial, the motion in limine referred to both the opinion testimony and the report as two separate things, recognizing that they are, in fact, two separate things. The assignment of error appears to only address the admission of the report itself and not the testimony. How do we reach the testimony, given that the assignment of error specifically only references the admission of the report?
Judge, I acknowledge that that's an issue at this point, especially after having considered the arguments of my esteemed colleague here. I will say that I went back and reread my brief to be clear. I referenced both testimony, oral testimony, and the
I understand
report.
You
yes,
do
sir.
That in the argument section.
Yes, sir.
But we have cases that say we are limited to the assignment of your argument outside the assignment of error we can't consider. And so the question is there any way to shoehorn the testimony into an assignment of error that says the error was allowing the autopsy report to be admitted into evidence?
Judge, I can't cite any specific authority that would allow the court to do that. What I would argue is the ends of justice at this point. I think that part of the issue here is that once that autopsy report was admitted into evidence, then the oral testimony that came in pretty much mirrored that, and it didn't really cause any additional harm there.
That really is my next question,
yes,
because
sir.
If we can't get to the oral testimony, even if we were to agree with you that the autopsy report is erroneously admitted, what harm was there? And it seems to me you've just conceded that there wasn't any, if you assume that the testimony is now law of the case.
I think that, yes, sir. I think that the testimony would be the law of the case. But I would ask the court to consider the ends of justice here. And I would ask the court to consider also the fact that I was not the trial counsel that handled this matter. And very unique circumstances arose. That attorney was no longer able to proceed. And I kind of got tossed in here with a very short timeline and a very difficult client. So that would be my mistake, which would be unfair, I think, to Mr. Davis at this point if the ends of justice are not met here.
But you would agree that on the record we have, even if we were to say able to go back and strike the admission of the report, all of the same substantive information came into the testimony.
It did come into the testimony. It was the exact same testimony and mirrored very largely the what was added to the medical examiner's report. But Judge, I would argue that.
And before we get to kind of the merits of the issue, I have one other kind of preliminary question.
Yes, sir.
And that's an argument at trial, not in the motion in limine, but an argument at trial, and it seemed that. Although the way it happened at trial with Judge O'Hare taking the recess and going back and revisiting his ruling on the report, there was an objection during the medical examiner's testimony.
Yes, sir.
And the objection seemed to be that she lacked a proper foundation. She did not hold the opinion to the requisite level of certainty.
Yes, sir.
And to me, that's different than saying that testimony goes, that an opinion goes to the ultimate issue. Those are two different objections. The assignment of error seems to track the foundational,
yes,
didn't
sir.
Hold it to the level of certainty, but most of the argument in the brief goes to ultimate issue.
Yes, sir.
Is it your position that the brief covers both issues, or was it the intention to abandon the foundational objection?
Judge, I think that I don't necessarily think that it was to abandon it, but I think it was to focus on the more significant issue here, because if that evidence doesn't come in, then that substantially changes what the jury has to consider with regard to whether or not this woman was actually murdered, and then whether or not the defendant was a criminal agent in her murder. And I think what I would point the court to is obviously the Nitt case, which I cited extensively in my brief here. And that case is exactly on point with regard to not only the testimony, the oral testimony, but also with regard to the autopsy report. In that case, this court in 1992 found that the trial court properly excluded the statement in the autopsy report and prevented the medical examiner from testifying that the evidence was consistent with the defendant's version of the facts, that killing was an accident. Here, this is sort of the flip because it's the Commonwealth's offered testimony as opposed to the defendant or the appellant's offered testimony here. But that's exactly what happened in this case. And I think a piece of evidence that I would point you to is the testimony of the medical examiner. She admitted on cross-examination that this statement in question wasn't even included in her original report. This is something that she went back and added after she consulted with law enforcement, after she probably, and couldn't recall specifically, but she probably also consulted with the prosecutor, the Commonwealth's attorney in this case. And judges, I think that highlights the fact that this is not proper. She's sort of rubber stamping the Commonwealth's theory of the case here. And then it goes to the next argument, Judge Russell, that you just pointed out, that there may not have been that foundation there necessary until she consulted with everybody.
What type of opinion is an opinion that something is consistent with homicidal violence? I mean, that doesn't sound like a medical examiner opinion to me.
It doesn't, Judge. I think that's the exact problem here. It rubber stamps the Commonwealth's theory of the case, and it puts this idea into the jury's head and doesn't allow them to make this decision on their own. It almost makes it impossible for them to make this decision on their own. It's right there in front of them. I think with regard to time, I'll move on to the sufficiency of the evidence argument here, and the issue really is a corpus delicti issue. We have this sort of alleged confession that was presented by Mr. Reese, and it's interesting that Mr. Reese was deceased at the time of the trial here, so what we have is his prior recorded testimony with cross-examination read into evidence, but there's really no corroboration of the elements of the confession that was presented by Mr. Reese. I think this is very similar to the Allen case, which was from the Supreme Court in 2014. In that case, the defendant made a full confession to these alleged sexual abuse here, and the only corroboration they had was that he had some opportunity, that the child was alone with this man, that the child slept in the bed with the man occasionally. And the court held that mere opportunity wasn't enough to corroborate this confession.
What do we make, though, of the multiple, and given where we are procedurally and
yes, sir,
how we have to view the record, the multiple lies that your client told about whether he was there or not, whether he struck her or not? I mean, like most favorable to the Commonwealth, he was there that night. He engaged in a physical altercation with her that night. He struck her that night. She died that night. And he told somebody else that he choked her until she was motionless.
Judge,
That sounds like more than opportunity to me.
Judge, I think, number one, I would point out that a lot of that evidence came by way of Mr. Reese, who, by the way, had been impeached with his criminal record,
But his being there that night, his engaging in a physical altercation, his striking her that night, whether accidentally or not, all comes from him.
Some of that, yes, sir. A lot of that does come from him. But I think the problem here, Judge, is that is there a chance for reasonable doubt? And I think a reasonable fact finder would have to have that, especially if you take out this opinion testimony and evidence that came in from the medical examiner. If you remove all of that and you just have the rest of the evidence that's before the court, you can't rise above the fact that it's possible and it's a reasonable possibility from the medical examiner that she...
In conducting a sufficiency review, do we do it that way? Do we take out, even if we agree with you that something shouldn't have come in, don't we conduct a sufficiency review? Aren't we required by statute to conduct a sufficiency review with all of that information included?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think that's true. But, Judge, I think that the Commonwealth can't rise above its own evidence. It is a plausible explanation that her physical condition could have been the cause of this death. I have to concede that this man, Mr. Davis, is not a good person. Clearly, the court's seen his record. That's part of the elements of the offense as it's charged. Clearly, even with his own admissions to law enforcement and multiple lots, he's not a good person. But the question here is whether or not he was the criminal agent in the death, the murder of this woman, the victim in this case, and I don't believe that the Commonwealth can prove that. And I'll reserve the rest. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jones. Hello again.
Hello again. May it please the court, I am John Jones on behalf of the Commonwealth, and we are asking the court to affirm Mr. Davis's convictions because the circuit court did not commit reversible error on either assignment of error. First, on the ultimate issue.
Since you raised the merits of it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any basis in Virginia law that you're aware of that allows an expert witness to give an opinion that witness does not hold to a reasonable degree of professional certainty?
I think that's my answer to that. Strictly speaking, no. But
okay.
If you listen to what Dr. K actually testified to, she said, looking at the forensic evidence, this is a possibility, this is another possibility, and she did hold that to a reasonable degree. If she had testified that this was homicide, that she was strangled, but when the parties poked at that a little bit, she didn't hold that opinion to the requisite degree of forensic certainty, then that would be a violation if the court went ahead and admitted it anyway.
My understanding of the general rule is that on direct, you have to offer the opinion to a reasonable degree of, in this case, forensic certainty. But on cross, then people can ask you, well, how certain are you of that? Is it possible it was something else? Is it possible that there were these 9, 10 other things? But then on direct, you can never say, well, it's possible that X happened. It's possible that Y happened. It's possible that Z happened. You have to hold the opinion to a reasonable degree of forensic certainty, or it is inadmissible. Am I wrong in that?
I am not aware of authority.
Are you aware of authority that agrees with what I say?
Off the top of my head, no. And it would probably, you know, if Davis had raised authority to that effect, then...
clearly the discussion before Judge O'Hara takes the recess is over whether it's to the requisite degree of certainty or not. I mean, that issue was raised in the trial court. Now, we can get into whether it's still raised in this brief or not, but...
And Your Honor, I mean, reading through the transcript, and not to cut you off, but reading through the transcript, that was mentioned, but it kind of blended together with a renewal of the motion in limine on the ultimate issue question, and that seemed to predominate, especially once the trial court came back and issued its ruling. And if there was a distinct challenge on foundation or on requisite degree of forensic certainty, it would have been incumbent on Davis to get a ruling on that.
Assume I think it's sufficient it was sufficiently raised to clear a 5A18 hurdle. Where do you go?
At the threshold, it's not covered by the the assignment of error. Let me take that back. The assignment of error appears to take issue with the foundation more than with the ultimate issue question. So, assuming it clears 5A18 as well, you know, Your Honor, I guess I would like a better opportunity to brief the merits on that. If the court wanted to order supplemental briefing on that issue, I'd be happy to submit that. But standing here before you, I honestly haven't looked closely at the law governing that.
We don't want you to spitball that.
No, and I don't want to spitball it either. You know, I would not want to concede away my case or misrepresent anything to the court either way. So if that is a live issue in this appeal, I would certainly be happy to brief it. Does that answer your question?
It sounds like as good as I'm going to get.
I'm afraid so at this point.
That's fine.
But there's also a question of waiver by voluntarily eliciting the same kind of evidence on cross that was objected to.
Well, and let me ask you about that. In Drinkard Knuckles, the Supreme Court made absolutely clear that simply crossing somebody on the issue doesn't waive it, doesn't waive the evidence of the same character. It doesn't subject you to that. It has to be something other than cross. You have to offer the same character of evidence yourself. Did they ever do that, or was it simply on cross?
It occurred during cross, but it went beyond standard cross of just trying to raise doubt about what the witness had initially expressed in their direct testimony, because they went really beyond the scope of what the Commonwealth had elicited by asking about, well, couldn't it also have been a heart problem? And you said that it could have been a heart problem, or that it was an equal probability that it was just a heart problem. And that they were trying to get Kay to testify that, I mean, it's as likely that it was just a heart failure as it was asphyxia.
But she gave testimony on direct on cause of death. That was
yes.
the whole purpose of calling her.
Yes.
Well, then, isn't all cross on potential causes of death fair game?
I mean,
how is that outside the scope of direct? If he died of X, well, could he have died of Y? Well, yes, of course he could have died of Y. I mean, that seems to me to be within the scope of direct.
But then going on beyond that and asking the expert to assign relative probabilities to the different causes of death with the expectation that they were just one was just as likely as the other, I think that goes beyond what would have been permissible on cross. But assuming that the court disagrees with me on that, there are other reasons to reject this challenge.
Is there a harmless error argument to be made?
I think so, Your Honor, and I made that on brief in a footnote at the end of the section, but that's not to minimize the strength of where I think that the harmless error, because if you, assuming we prevail on the corpus delicti, you have a lot of evidence in addition to a pretty detailed confession by Davis coming through Reese's testimony is overwhelming evidence of his guilt. And in light of all that, the fact that Kay testified in a pretty equivocal way as far as it's possible that there was homicidal violence involved in this is really pales in comparison to the rest of the evidence implicating Davis.
Do you agree with appellants that anything that came in through the report came in through the testimony as well? And therefore, if the testimony is not in front of us, no harm?
I agree that... Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I agree that there was largely the same testimony that came in through the report and the testimony, largely the same evidence that came in through both. And if the court cannot reach the testimony, then I don't think there's any way to go. I guess I kind of shifted gears in my brain after the earlier questioning. But assuming that the testimony cannot be disturbed on appeal at this point, I think that's an alternative reason to find that.
I want to ask you about another one of your procedural arguments, and that's essentially that the Supreme Court of Virginia already decided this issue in the habeas context.
Yes, Ron.
You would agree that the only issue that the Supreme Court addressed regarding the autopsy report in the state habeas was whether it went to the ultimate issue or not.
Ultimate issue was the only thing raised on habeas, and ultimate issue was the only as relevant in this appeal.
Then, as to the foundational objection regarding the level of certainty, there is no ruling from the Virginia Supreme Court that would preclude a different ruling now.
I don't think so, and I think that really that underscores what the trial court thought that it was addressing, because there's no indication in the Supreme Court of Virginia's habeas ruling that there was anything about a foundation issue there. So when the trial court came in and said, look, this ultimate issue opinion, I don't know if it binds me or not, but I'm not going to go against it, so denying your objection at this time, that put Davis on notice if he was trying to still forward this foundation issue at that time, that he needs to secure a ruling on that. And I think that goes to the preservation of that. The trial court never made an explicit ruling on that, and there's case law from this court and the Supreme Court of Virginia that if a litigant doesn't secure a ruling on an issue from the trial court, that they can't then pursue that on appeal.
But if the objection is made, and clearly Judge O'Hara understood it to have been made because he asked the Commonwealth, don't we have a problem here if she doesn't hold it to the requisite level of forensic certainty, but then allows the testimony, isn't that a ruling on the objection?
I don't think it's an implicit ruling on the objection when the trial court goes on to research a sort of related issue that's also been raised at the same time, answers that second question, never answers the first question.
But evidentiary objections at trial are fundamentally different than things that are reduced to written orders normally. Basically, I object, I list my reason for objecting, the court either allows the testimony or it doesn't. That's my ruling, right? I mean, the court clearly recognized the argument had been made.
Certainly, and I guess my response would be that the court actually went into recess. They had lunch in the interim here, and the court researched this and in the meantime got its hands on the Supreme Court order from the habeas case and came back and delivered its ruling and said, I'm noting your objection. But I think that where the circuit court was relying on an order that didn't address one of the two objections that have been raised, that Davis has to say something at that point to carry that forward and to get to clarify that. So you're ruling on both of these based on this order. I think the fact that it dies there in the trial record and is never mentioned again, I don't think that it's preserved, Your Honor. But again, there are other reasons to reject that. Not sure that's even the best one, but that would be the Commonwealth's position on that. So the Davis talks a lot about Nick. Nick is distinguishable, I think, here for two reasons. First off, in Nick, the expert testified that the evidence was consistent with the defendant's theory of the case, and that was basically giving carte blanche to anything that the defendant wanted to say. Here we have a lot more nuanced and a lot more equivocal testimony out of Kay. And probably more importantly, though, in Nick, this court was affirming a trial court's exclusion of the expert testimony, saying the court did not abuse its discretion by keeping that out. Here, Davis has to demonstrate that the trial court abused its discretion by letting this testimony in. And so it's not the same standard. It's much higher standard here to achieve reversal on this issue than what the court was considering in Nick. And I don't think that the trial court, that Davis can in any event demonstrate that the trial court abused its discretion in making the ruling that it did, whether we're talking about the report or the testimony, honestly, if the court did breach the merits on either one of those. And again, I do think that the Supreme Court of Virginia's habeas opinion is at least persuasive on the ultimate issue. I didn't brief it. The first thing I thought was, ooh, cool, collateral estoppel or something along those lines. But obviously the fact that it was habeas didn't allow me to go that far with it. But I think that it's extremely probative. And I don't think that the trial court, it could be said that it erred by listening to that guidance. And again, I highlight that Supreme Court didn't just go down the Strickland factors and say no prejudice. It actually rejected the merits, the underlying merits of the ultimate issue question. And so, at any rate, if I could talk briefly about the sufficiency issue, the corpus delicti rule requires only slight corroboration to admit a confession as substantive evidence. And here we have a lot of corroboration. I wanted to read the requirement of corroboration. It's not necessary that there be independent corroboration of all the contents of the confession or even of all the elements of the crime. The requirement of corroboration is limited to the facts constituting the corpus delicti, and that's out of Watkins from 238 Virginia. But here we had numerous corroborating facts of the corpus delicti. Most probably importantly, we have all the injuries, 15 different injuries, I think, were detailed to Dowell's body. She had Davis's DNA under her fingernails. Davis didn't disagree that she had scratched him even. He just had a different and changing at times account of how each scratch was placed. There's signs of a struggle, a hole in the wall, the broken iron. There are signs of entry through the window with the chalking on disturbed on the windowsill and then tracked in onto the couch cushion. Dowell's car was missing. That was also corroborative of elements of how the burglary took place and then how Davis left in Dowell's car. And that's actually something that he went and just flatly denied that he had ever said that when they had it coming in from several sources that he had admitted to it earlier. And Dowell's blood on Davis's shirt. And then Dowell's fear and Davis's threats. I don't know that it necessarily goes to the corroboration for the corpus delicti. It might not, but I think it definitely does go toward the overarching sufficiency question to the extent that that's been raised by Davis's arguments beyond just the corpus delicti question. Allen's distinguishable. There's no evidence in that case that there was any crime committed, any touching, any molestation. Here we have Dowell is deceased. I see that I'm running out of time, so I would just ask that the court would affirm the convictions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Bailey.
I think where I'd like to start now in rebuttal is to refer the court to the, and I'm going to mispronounce this, but the Betancourt opinion out of this court from 1998. And that was the case where the gentleman died of the overdose, and his friend, his cohort from that evening who was using cocaine, provided cocaine, was charged with his murder. And in that case, this court overturned that conviction and did that because the evidence didn't exclude the reasonable theory that the victim in that case accidentally ingested the excessive lethal dose of cocaine. And so the Commonwealth didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt the requisite criminal agency. And I think that that's sort of the issue here. I mean, clearly we have a dead person, clearly. It's not clear that she was, she's dead as a result of criminal agency. We have a medical examiner saying that she cannot determine a cause of death. Are there suspicious circumstances? Absolutely. But there's also another reasonable theory of her death, and that is that it was natural causes, that her physical condition, her heart, her weight, all of those things may have contributed. We don't know what the actual events were that led up to her passing. But
even let's assume for a moment that all of those things contributed, that a 135-pound female would not have suffocated to death after being yoked up. That still wouldn't excuse or change it from murder, would it? I mean, you take your victim as you find him.
You do take your victim as you find them, but I think that the Commonwealth still has to exclude that reasonable theory of innocence, and there's no exclusion here.
Well, isn't the hypothesis of innocence a factual determination that's made by the trier of fact?
Yes. But I think that in this case, that's clouded by the fact that we have this other testimony coming in, and that basically co-signs, rubber stamps, that is kind of the term I like to use in this case, that rubber stamps the Commonwealth's theory of the case. It almost makes it impossible for the jury not to make that finding. And so based on all of that, I would ask the court to, unless there are any other questions, I would ask the court to consider the remedies suggested in my brief.
Thank you, counsel. No further questions.